Today is Tuesday, May 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the deadliest toll on journalists after double suicide bombings near Kabul.
So this is a really devastating attack on the press community in Afghanistan.
A caravan of migrants are at the U.S.-Mexico border hoping for asylum. Israel claims it has proof that Iran has broken promises on nuclear weapons. Also ahead, the movie that broke records around the world over the weekend. It's all on today's International Edition. A twin suicide bombing Monday in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, killed at least 26 people, including 9 journalists. AP correspondent Joseph Krauss reports Islamic State attackers appeared to be specifically targeting journalists, among others.
It was a coordinated double suicide bombing in central Kabul today. It killed more than 24 people, including 9 journalists. This is the worst attack on journalists in Afghanistan since at least 2001. And it seems that what happened was there was a suicide bomber that struck in the center of the city. And then as reporters gathered to the scene to take pictures and film video, another bomber was concealed among the reporters and set off his suicide vest.
In a statement, VOA said it was saddened by the loss of journalists from its sister network, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Liberty, in the Kabul blasts. It said, quote, "We join RFERL President Thomas Kent in deploring this cowardly act against non-combatants and extend our deepest condolences to the families of all of those who've lost their lives in today's deadly attacks." With the World Press Freedom Day on May 3rd, Monday's tragedy is a reminder of the dangers that journalists face every day to bring global audiences accurate, objective, and reliable news. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks more about this tragedy with Kabul-based reporter Hassan Ghul.
The area that was selected for these attacks is highly secured area where U.S. Embassy is located. NATO headquarters is also located there. So there was an Afghan intelligence facility or office located, which was apparently the target of the suicide bombing. And it started with one of the bombers riding a motorbike, rammed his motorbike into this facility, blowing up this area, and at least 5 security personnel there were instantly killed. And this is the area which is not far from the central Kabul, where most of the media houses are also located. That's why, within minutes, a large number of journalists with their television crews and rescue teams rushed to the scene. They arrived there, and the second bomber was actually disguised as a journalist and also was carrying a camera in his hand and had gotten somehow the security clearance, because you cannot move in this area without a security ID. So that bomber was also, he rushed to the scene together with this big crowd of journalists. And when everybody was there on the scene trying to find out exactly what happened, that's when this bomber detonated explosives strapped to his body. And that's what actually caused most of the fatalities in today's this twin suicide bombing.
And I believe there were several prominent journalists, including the AFP's chief photographer in Kabul, Shah Marai.
Yes, that was a major loss in terms of the history of Afghan media. You know, the way Afghanistan has been, news out of Afghanistan has been covered over the past 17 years. This journalist, Shah Marai, who, you know, in 1996, I remember I used to travel to Kabul, and he was just a driver for the AFP bureau in Kabul. And from there, you know, this talented driver, you know, rose to a situation today where he had become the chief photographer for AFP. And to his credit, there has been amazing pictures that the world has seen. And unfortunately, you know, he got killed today in this attack, and a major loss that the Afghan media, which has been a success story over the last 17 years, suffered this major loss. And this journalist, Shah Marai, you know, he had 6 children. And only recently he had written an article sort of describing how he has been covering news out of Afghanistan, and that how it has been dangerous for him and his family, that they rarely would go out for a walk or for a picnic, fearing, that's what he said in his article, that, you know, one day they could become a target of a car bombing or a suicide bomber could hit them. And unfortunately, that's what happened today.
And I believe there were also journalists from Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty.
Yes, and that was another setback to these young, talented Afghan journalists. These journalists, especially associated with Radio Free Europe and Mashal Television in Kabul, they have played a key role, like covering from the front lines this war that has plagued Afghanistan over the last 17 years. And it is very rare to find a good journalist in Afghanistan who has knowledge, who has language skills, particularly English-speaking journalists. And those, you know, many of those who got killed today are sort of the cream of the media in Kabul.
An Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the deadliest ever assault on media workers in Afghanistan. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. President Trump postpones a steel tariff decision for Canada, the EU, and Mexico. Autism poses special challenges in Africa. Iraq's first election after IS brings unconventional coalitions. And porn star Stormy Daniels sues President Trump for defamation. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari met with U.S. President Donald Trump in Washington Monday in the first visit by a sub-Saharan African leader to Trump's White House. Talks focused on the threat of terrorism and economic growth in Africa's most populous country of almost 200 million people. Nigeria has been plagued by extremist group Boko Haram, which launched an insurgency 9 years ago with the aim of creating an Islamic State. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and hundreds of schoolgirls kidnapped as the group gained notoriety and spread to neighboring countries, posing one of the most severe threats of West Africa's Sahel region in recent years.
We are doing all we can to secure the release of the remaining abducted school girls from Defchi and Chibok.
Well, last year, the Trump administration approved a $600 million sale of high-technology attack planes and equipment to support Nigerian military operations against Boko Haram and IS terrorists and to monitor drugs, weapons, and human trafficking. The deal was stalled under the Obama administration amid concerns of human rights violations in the West African country. Buhari, along with South African President Jacob Zuma, was among the first African leaders whom Trump spoke with on the phone upon taking office. The White House is praising new intelligence from Israel on Iran's nuclear weapons program, though officials in Washington have stopped short of charging Tehran with outright violations that its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu first leveled the new accusations Monday during a televised news conference, saying the cache of documents and other files show Iran has brazenly been untruthful about nuclear weapons and its nuclear weapons program.
Iran lied, big time. After signing the nuclear deal in 2015, Iran intensified its efforts to hide its secret nuclear file. In 2017, Iran moved its nuclear weapons files to a highly secret location in Tehran.
Intelligence experts and documents or diplomats say much of the evidence the Israeli leader presented during his news conference dates to before Iran signed the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran, too, downplayed the intelligence, with Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif taking to Twitter to deride the Israeli claims. President Trump was vague when he spoke earlier during a White House news conference with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
That is just not an acceptable situation. And I've been saying that's happening. They're not sitting back idly. They're setting off missiles, which they say are for television purposes. I don't think so.
The new round of allegations against Iran comes at a critical time. The Trump administration has given U.S. allies a May 12th deadline to fix what president sees as the deal's flaws. Guy Ziv, assistant professor at the School of International Service at American University, said Netanyahu's statement did provide some revelations.
Well, he did in the sense of showing, demonstrating that the Iranians had been lying all along about their intentions, as well as lying about statements they had made to the international community about their nuclear program. So what he revealed was nothing short of an incredible Mossad operation, managing to get all those documents, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of documents and files from Iran's secret facilities is definitely an impressive feat for the Mossad. However, we're talking about something that we knew the Iranians had been doing, which is lying. So perhaps it convinced the few people who did not believe that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. But for the rest of us, this wasn't really news. I don't think that he was able to demonstrate any, there was no revelation of Iranian noncompliance with a nuclear agreement. And I think that that's what people were hoping to see, and he wasn't able to deliver on that.
U.S. officials have so far stopped short of accusing Iran of actually violating the landmark nuclear deal. As recently as last month, top U.S. military commanders, including the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, told U.S. lawmakers that Tehran is in compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. More than 150 asylum seekers in a caravan of Central Americans were not allowed to turn themselves in to U.S. border inspectors for a second straight day Monday. U.S. Customs and Border Protection says a San Diego border crossing facility has reached capacity and that it will resume processing asylum applicants when it has more space and resources. Caravan organizers say the U.S. refusal is aimed at avoiding having to deal with the Central American asylum seekers. President Trump, meanwhile, used the situation to talk about his views on immigration in the United States.
And now we're working on the border with the worst laws any country, no matter where you go, all over the world, they can't even believe it. And we're doing the best we can with it.
Well, joining us now to discuss this further and what it all means is immigration attorney Catherine Ferrigno. So how unusual is this caravan situation?
I think it's unusual, not necessarily in someone fleeing their home country out of fear. I think the amount of people in this case is what makes this very unusual. A lot of children, just the sheer volume of the people fleeing at once is what makes this a rather unusual situation.
And what are the rules surrounding asylum into the United States? I know that's their ultimate hope.
The rules are not necessarily that they all have to be accepted, but the government should be at least hearing out their claim and at least screening to see if these people do qualify for asylum. And if so, then they do have a right to have their case heard. So not necessarily to be everybody accepted in, but everybody should at least have the chance to make their case.
They obviously have to be in a situation, if they're seeking asylum, that they feel they're in imminent danger?
It's basically that they're seeking protection in the United States from some sort of fear that they face in their home country. Now, it can't just be generalized violence, and that's some of the concern with the amount of people that are coming, because it really needs to be based on race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So with the large amount of people that are coming, what it seems to be is that most of the people are leaving out of a generalized fear of violence from their home country. So that's why they're really going to have to get into the specifics of the individual claims that people are making.
That they feel their lives are in danger and that they're being persecuted? Is that what you mean?
Also that it's going to fall under one of those protected classes. Because if you think about it just in terms of numbers, El Salvador, for instance, I talked to a number of people that are from there that face fear just living their day-to-day lives. And so right now, people are just very scared, the average person. And so if everybody got up and left, the sheer number of volume, the average person just has maybe a generalized fear of the everyday violence. And they may not fall under persecution based on, say, race or religion or one of those protected classes. It has to fall under one of those classes under the law.
What sorts of proof do they need?
Something to basically make their claim seem valid from the person who will be interviewing them to understand that this is a real claim. That can be, if the person received a threat, something maybe if they were left a note that it was in writing that they received this threat, bringing that to with them when they flee. If there is documentation of maybe if they were physically harmed, maybe bringing those medical records and showing that as well. Also, reports of others similarly situated to that individual showing that this is maybe some sort of widespread. If a particular religion, for example, is targeted in that country, showing reports on that as well. So something to back up the claim that they are making. That also could be testimony from other people, and it also can be their own detailed testimony.
Monday, the president's noted what was happening and said basically that our immigration system is a mess. Is that accurate?
Well, unfortunately, I guess it's kind of becoming that way. Right now, what we're really seeing as practitioners are that things are just not efficient with the sheer volume of people that are being placed in removal proceedings. The court system is just so backed up. It can't handle all of the additional people that are being placed in removal proceedings, people that are really not a threat to this country, who were not a priority in the past, are now being placed in removal proceedings. And it was already pretty at capacity, it felt like, prior. And so now you're throwing in all these additional individuals. And if we start taking away programs like TPS and DACA, unfortunately, it's just going to get worse. Interviews are taking so much longer to come by in standard cases, and other cases where interviews were not happening in the past are now happening. There's just not enough resources to accommodate.
So in other words, what you're saying is we're deporting more people than ever, and some of them that aren't really a threat to the country.
I'm not sure statistic-wise how many people would actually have a final order of removal, but I can say that the more people being placed in removal proceedings has certainly gone up, people that are not necessarily a high priority.
Now, would that be in the last year since President Trump was elected, or is this just in the last couple of years in general?
No, I would say it's within the past year because we've had increased ICE raids where these people are being targeted. They're actually seeking out individuals who are undocumented, whether or not they are a priority. In the past, people with criminal history would be placed as a higher priority. Now, even without criminal history, an individual here undocumented could be placed in removal proceedings. There's a higher risk of that happening now.
Okay, well, the Border Patrol officials, in the case of this caravan of people that are now at the border with Mexico, basically telling them, sorry, we are at capacity. So what exactly does that mean? They're at capacity as far as people seeking asylum and being held down there or being processed? What exactly does that mean?
People being processed. So all the detention centers and all of the resources that are available for the individuals are currently at capacity is what they're saying. This has happened in the past. In 2016, there was a case where there were a lot of people coming over from Haiti, and the same situation did happen. Ideally, these people can all have their claims heard. It's just that we only have so much space in detention centers and resources available to process everything and move everything along. And so people may just have to wait some time before their particular claim can be heard.
All right. We appreciate your filling us in on all of this. It's immigration attorney Catherine Ferrigno. And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues.
The entire time I knew him, he only ever had one goal. To wipe out half the universe.
A whole lot of superheroes added up to a whole lot of ticket sales. Over the weekend, Avengers Infinity Wars opened with shock and awe, earning $250 million in the box office over the weekend, edging past Star Wars The Force Awakens to set the highest opening weekend of all time. Infinity War, which brings together some two dozen superheroes in the 10-year culmination of Marvel Studios' cinematic universe, also set a new global opening record with $630 million, even though it's yet to open in China, the world's second largest movie market. It opens there May 11th. Joining us now to hear more about the movie is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. What did you think?
You know, I would think at this point, after this is their 10th anniversary for the Marvel films and for them starting this Marvel universe, cinematic universe, as they call it, and I think that the public or myself would have superhero comic book fatigue at the movies, and I dread going to these films. And every time I come out of them, they are an amazing, fun experience. We're not talking about Warner Brothers in DC with Batman. We're talking what they've done. They've tied all these movies together. They all do crossovers. And this is the ultimate one. And we have a villain named Thanos, who's from the planet Titan, who has one mission. He wants to take over the universe. He wants to rule the universe. He has the attitude that he can save all life in the universe under his rule. But he can't do it without these Infinity Stones, these six stones that he puts in the special gauntlet where he can control all different types of reality and people and everything. And, of course, the Avengers are out to stop. And if you think about the Avengers and all the Marvel superheroes to be put into this final film, when I say final, I don't mean that they're not going to make any more. It just wraps up the tenure of all these actors and their characters over the last decade. And you think to yourself, how are they going to do this without making it look corny or just like gratuitous? And they do. The Russo brothers, who directed this film, absolutely turn in a movie that the story-wise is Greek tragedy. It's Shakespearean. I know I'm using these words to describe how incredible this movie is, but it really takes the comic book movie to another level. It really does. There's emotional scenes, scenes of genocide, scenes of humor, you know, the levity in the movie, and then seeing some of these great characters who meet for the first time, like, you know, Tony Stark, who plays Iron Man, and, you know, Doctor Strange, seeing them in scenes together. So everyone's got their own kind of storyline going on that ultimately leads to destroying or defeating Thanos, you know, the villain played by Josh Brolin. And there's so many spoilers in this, Laura, you have no idea. I mean, I've tread lightly because even the director sent out a note saying to critics and to fans, please don't reveal the ending or the spoilers, because they're changing. They're in terms of where the movies are going, where the characters are going. I mean, I was shocked at the cliffhanger that this movie left. And it was just like Empire Strikes Back when Han Solo got carted off by Boba Fett and we had to wait 3 years, you know, back in the 80s to see what would happen. Mm-hmm. It is that kind of cliffhanger. People are going to be like going, no way. It leaves it so ambiguous and so up in the air about where we're going with this franchise and the story of these superheroes that it's just delicious. I love it because people are like tearing up their seats and going no and screaming, and I just love it. I love it when, and it's been a long time since we had something like this, but it's just going to go down as one of the best superhero films of all time.
Wow, quite an endorsement. We'll have to check it out. Well, that is Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, Kenya has banned a new film by the celebrated Kenyan director, Wanuri Kahayu, now saying it violates Kenyan law and morals. Her new film, Rafiki, is a coming-of-age tale of two girls falling in love, inspired by an award-winning short story by a Ugandan author. In May, the film will become the first feature-length movie from Kenya ever to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival in May. VOA's Daniel Scherf met with Kihio in Nairobi and has this report.
Kenya's film industry will take another step onto the world stage when Wanuri Kahayu's film Rafiki becomes the first Kenyan feature to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. But while Rafiki, which means friend in Swahili, is welcomed abroad, the lesbian love story won't be showing in cinemas in Kenya.
I'm incredibly disappointed that the film in Kenya was banned. If there was ever a time for Kenya to make a lead in Africa and to show that it respects freedom of expression and freedom of speech, it would have been now.
Kenya's film board says Rafiki's storyline promotes and legitimizes homosexual relations, which are illegal in Kenya.
There are areas that we recommended that they cannot be suitable for the Kenyan market. They could be suitable for Cannes,
And it's a great movie, no doubt about it. The theme is relevant and it is true. But just like corruption or crime, the fact that they are happening does not make it right.
Kahu refused demands to change the ending from a hopeful and joyful African story, part of a style she calls Afro bubblegum. Kahu says the film is about speaking out for and humanizing sexual minorities who are often shunned in Africa.
We really hope that this adds to the conversation of the LGBT community in Africa. It is a voice that is not heard enough. And we hope that this film begins to open channels of conversation, of inclusion, and of freedom, and of unity of all. Abu.
This is not the first time Kahu has broken new ground in Kenyan cinema. Her first feature film, From a Whisper, is a fictionalized account of the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombing in Nairobi. A terrorist is among the main characters. And before there was Black Panther, Kahu was winning awards for her science fiction film, Pumzi, set in Africa.
I think it's incredibly important to have Afrofuturism as a subgenre, although I'd much prefer that there wasn't an Afro at the beginning of it. I really, really hope that at some point we're seen as equal humans without having to explain that people of color are different and therefore deserve a different genre.
Kahu says she plans to appeal the ban on Rafiki before Kenya's constitutional court. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Nairobi.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The continuing state of emergency in Turkey, imposed after the July 2016 coup attempt, has led to the severe curtailment of many fundamental freedoms, according to the latest State Department human rights report. John Sullivan, who was serving as acting Secretary of State at the release of the report, pointed in particular to the detention of tens of thousands of individuals, including journalists and academics, under an ongoing state of emergency that has undermined the rule of law in Turkey. The Human Rights Report notes that as of the end of 2017, Turkish authorities had dismissed or suspended more than 100,000 civil servants from their jobs, arrested or imprisoned more than 50,000 citizens, and closed more than 1,500 non-governmental organizations on terrorism-related grounds since the coup attempt, primarily for alleged ties to cleric Fethullah Gulen and his movement. The government has accused Gulen of masterminding the coup attempt. Arrested in October 2016, U.S. citizen Pastor Andrew Brunson remains in a Turkish prison after being charged with action in support of a terrorist organization and espionage. NASA scientist and U.S. citizen Sergen Golc was arrested in July 2016 and convicted in February 2018 without credible evidence for being a member of a terrorist organization. These cases and those of the three Mission Turkey employees are symptomatic of the breakdown in the rule of law that has occurred under the state of emergency, which has facilitated arbitrary arrest and detention. This has been the fate of tens of thousands of individuals, mostly Turkish citizens, who are unlikely to receive a fair trial and due process in the face of executive interference in the judiciary. Promoting and defending human rights and fundamental freedoms are central to who we are as a country, said Mr. Sullivan. The United States will continue to support those around the world struggling for human dignity and liberty, including in Turkey.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.